Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 46 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Challenge That Will Not Wait. About my conversation with Drew Lyon, Extension Wheat Specialist at Washington State University, who holds the Endowed Chair in Small Grains Extension and Research, which was created by a $1.5 million endowment funded by the Washington Grain Commission in 2011. When I heard that Lyon, who lives in Pullman, was going to be in Spokane in September to pick up his daughter from the airport, I suggested he come up a little earlier so we could grab dinner together and then go back to my place to do a podcast about weed science. It sounds boring, doesn't it? Weed science. But when it comes to challenges facing eastern Washington wheat farmers, it's anything but. In fact, figuring out how to control weeds economically may be the biggest challenge farmers face in the future. Why's that? One word. Resistance. Maybe two words. Weed resistance. Final answer, three words. Herbicide weed resistance. If you're an eastern Washington wheat farmer who doesn't know about resistance, then you haven't been paying attention. If what Lyon says is correct, and he strikes me as a guy who doesn't like to be wrong, then herbicide weed resistance is going to be a hell of a headache for eastern Washington farmers who either don't know how fast it's coming or its repercussions. We'll get into that momentarily, but first, I was curious to ask Lyon how someone finds out about weed science as a young person, let alone becomes one of the best weed scientists in the field. I asked him if weeds were something that interested him from a young age.
I can't say that ever appeared on my radar, Scott. As a young man, I enjoyed fishing, and I was going to be a fisheries biologist. I always enjoyed science, and I think I was in a junior college taking a botany class, and I really enjoyed it, and my instructor informed me that he thought I ought to become a botanist, and I said, well, I'm not sure I want to be somebody sitting in the lab all the time. I like being outdoors. And so he suggested I look into agronomy at the University of Illinois. And that's kind of when the whole thing started. And I've found it to be a very interesting and rewarding career. And it's always changing. You know, in the 80s, we had lots of chemistry. Herbicide-resistant crops were kind of a pipe dream. We've seen some amazing things come along, but I can't say we've always stewarded them very well. And now we're at risk of losing some of that tremendous technology because of our inability to steward the products well and maintain their viability long term.
Tell us about herbicide resistance. What exactly is herbicide resistance?
Okay, the technical explanation is that it's when a weed is susceptible, at one time it's susceptible or can be controlled by a particular herbicide, and then over time of using that herbicide, you can no longer control it. That is called herbicide resistance. Some weeds are naturally tolerate a herbicide, and so that's not resistance. What resistance is when it was controllable, and over time it becomes uncontrollable with that herbicide. So that's herbicide resistance. How it happens is through a process called natural selection. And so if people remember back to their high school biology class or maybe college biology class, they'll remember a gentleman named Charles Darwin who proposed the concept of natural selection whereby species evolve over time. So you put a selection pressure on a population, and those species that can handle the selection pressure, survive, and reproduce with that selection pressure, they're the ones that take over the population with time. In this case, with weeds, there's usually, with any herbicide, there's usually a small number of plants out there, billions and billions of weeds. There's a few individuals that have a gene that confers resistance to this herbicide. They're usually at a very, very low level, but if you keep applying the herbicide over and over again, you select for those individuals that can tolerate that herbicide, and they go from being a very small portion of the population, one in a million, one in 10 million, to if you do it enough times, they are now the predominant individuals in that population, and that population then is considered to be resistant to the herbicide.
When it comes to chemicals that weeds have resistance to, is there a most important chemical?
I don't know that there's a most important chemical, other than usually the ones that develop resistance are the ones where you're using the chemical the most. So if you have a chemical that you're putting out on lots and lots of acres, you're more likely to find those individuals that are resistant to it. Case in point, glyphosate, a wonderful chemical, low environmental toxicology, low persistence in the environment. However, it's used on a lot of acres, especially since Roundup Ready crops have come out. So it's gone out on lots and lots of acres, and we're starting to see a lot of weed resistance to glyphosate. So the more you use the chemical, the more ground you spray it on, the more plants you spray it on, the more likely you are to find resistance to it. And those are the chemistries where you tend to find herbicide resistance, the ones that start off very effective and then over time become less so.
So tank mixes have become the latest thing in terms of trying to overcome herbicide resistance. Do tank mixes work?
Tank mixes are an effective tool. They will help in the fight, but they aren't the sole answer to the situation. So having two mechanisms of action in the tank, so not necessarily just two herbicides, but two herbicides with different mechanisms of action, both effective on the weed, are necessary, or you rotate different mechanisms of action. So though that is an effective approach to slowing it, you will never eliminate the development of herbicide resistance. I think all we can do is slow it down, and tank mixing is one way of slowing it down. But there are some problems with that as well.
I want to know what the problems are, but I also want to know about three-way tank mixes, because that's what some farmers are doing now.
You know, the more mechanisms you can get in the tank, the better. One of the problems, I don't know if it's a problem, but one of the concerns I have with tank mixes is that it would have been a great strategy at the dawn of herbicides if we were always able to do that. But what we tend to do now with tank mixes is tank mix option one no longer is that effective, so we add tank mix number two. Now we really only have one mechanism of action that's effective against that weed. If you add a third one and two of the three are effective, that will slow it down. That's beneficial. But we've kind of come at herbicide resistance and tank mixing in a pell-mell sort of way. You know, one thing, okay, that doesn't work, we'll bring another. We really should have come at it from the very beginning. We should have never just applied glyphosate alone. It should have always been tank mixed. Now people are saying, well, let's tank mix. Well, it's a little too late. Now glyphosate's not working so well, so adding something that makes it work a little better isn't the solution. You have to get some different chemistries. So, and we don't have as many chemistries now, so it becomes harder and harder to do that job effectively. But tank mixing, to the extent that we can do it, we should do it. It does slow it down.
Is it as simple as just adding three chemicals together? I find that hard to believe. Don't these chemicals have antagonism against each other?
You know, it's totally dependent on what chemicals you're talking about. There are some that are antagonistic, some are not. What you want to do is make sure you have different mechanisms of action that are effective. And it's really kind of difficult to pick three different mechanisms of action, three herbicides with three different mechanisms of action that are all effective on the broad range of weeds we tend to have in the field. It sounds simple. It really isn't. So, you know, it's a good idea in theory. In practice, it becomes difficult. And again, one of the reasons it's difficult is because we've already burned out so many chemistries out there that it's really hard to find two or three effective mechanisms of action that all have activity on the weeds we're going after.
There is a new chemical. It's called Talinor, and I believe it has a new mechanism of action, doesn't it?
No, Talinor, it's a new product, a new herbicide. However, it's got the same mechanism of action as another product that's been on the market for a while now called Husky. So they're both group 27 HPPD inhibitors. So that's the same mechanism of action. They might go about it slightly differently, but they're in the same class. And so you really, rotating from Husky to Talonor isn't much of a rotation. You're putting very similar selection pressure on the population if that's your rotation, because again, they're the same mechanism of action. Work maybe slightly differently, buys you a little time, but it's not a long-term solution. So there actually has not been a new mechanism of action for herbicide released in the marketplace for over 25 years now. And one of the scary things is there's no new mechanism of action in the near future. There's nothing in advanced testing at this time. So it means we're at least 5 to 10 years out from having it. And if you look at what's happened in the chemical industry over the last 30 years, as long as I've been in the business, there were a lot of chemical companies back in the 80s with discovery programs coming out with new herbicides. Today, through consolidation, we're down to really 3 or 4 chemical companies that have the ability to do new discovery. And the easy stuff's been found. It's going to be hard. And so we've always been able to, when one chemical failed, we've always been able to go to the shelf and find another chemical to replace it. I don't think we're in that era anymore. New chemistries, especially new mechanisms of action, are going to be the rare event going forward. So it's very important that we protect the herbicides that are working today, make sure we sustain them for the long term, because we're not going to have a lot of new products coming down the road.
I was reading recently that there are glyphosate-resistant kochia in sugar beet fields in Oregon. Do we need to be concerned about resistant kochia in Oregon?
I think we probably do. Kochia is a tumbleweed. It moves. It can move several miles, tumbling and spreading seeds. It might take a little while for those particular biotypes to get here. I think maybe the bigger risk is that the way that developed was they were using Roundup Ready sugar beets, and Roundup was their sole means of controlling weeds in those sugar beets, and they selected for the resistant biotypes. And if we continue to use Roundup, if Eastern Washington farmers use Roundup continuously in their fallow systems and in their farming systems, we're likely to select for kochia that's resistant to glyphosate as well. We've done it with Russian thistle now. We do have Russian thistle that's resistant to glyphosate, and my guess is that that's going to spread fairly quickly, both through its tumbling mechanism and through just more selection for more resistant varieties or biotypes, and that it won't be long that we will not be able to control Russian thistle in eastern Washington with glyphosate. And the same may be true of kochia in those areas where kochia is a problem.
Now, when you say it won't be long, I mean, you know, there's a lot of ways to define long. What are we talking about here? How long? Do you have any examples?
Okay, so I was with the University of Nebraska in Scotts Bluff from 1990 to 2012 when I moved here to Washington. In 2007, there were 4 fields in Kansas where glyphosate-resistant kochia were identified. So that was the known extent of the problem in 2007. 7 years later, in 2014, 2.2 million acres of cropland in the Great Plains from Canada all the way down to Texas were infested with glyphosate-resistant kochia. So what is that? 7 years from 4 fields to 2.2 million acres. That's about how long.
At what point do we begin to notice the resistance?
At various points. Because there's can be multiple things going on. My colleague, Dr. Ian Burke, has had a resistance testing program going on for a number of years where people who suspect they have a resistance problem send him seed. He tests it in the greenhouse to see whether it truly is resistant. The good news is more than half of those come back not being resistance. It's something else, either the weather or the application technique or something. So a lot of what we see could be just environmental or poor spray conditions or the wrong rate at the wrong time. Resistance can kind of be confounded by these environmental effects, application error effects. But generally, it tends to happen quickly. We get a sense that maybe things aren't working real well 1 year, and then if we continue with what we're doing, it just is in your face. And it becomes, it goes from being, is that resistance, to, oh my gosh, Yes, I have resistance. So it happens very quickly when it does happen. But there's usually a year or two in there where you're kind of wondering, you know, was it too hot that day? Did I have too cold a temperatures? Did I not get the right amount in the tank? And then after a year or two of that, then it becomes pretty obvious. You usually have what would be considered pretty much a total failure. It's part of because of how it happens. We start with a very low population. We enrich that population from 1 in 1,000,000. After about 4 or 5 years, we might see 1 or 2% of the plants not being controlled. And we think, well, that herbicide is not working quite as well, but maybe it was something else. And we go from that 1 or 2% 1 year to the next year. If we do the same thing, we have 70-80% of our population now. So it explodes very quickly. We don't see it coming. It's been coming for a while, but when it really hits, it hits. It seems like it just happens overnight because you go from 1 or 2% to 80 very, very quickly.
So let's go back to Russian thistle. Russian thistle is a weed problem in the summer fallow area of eastern Washington. Are we sitting on a Russian thistle herbicide-resistant time bomb?
I believe that growers within the next 3 to 5 years will not be able to rely on glyphosate to control Russian thistle in eastern Washington. They're going to have to start using more different chemistry, often more expensive chemistry, to get the job done. Paraquat still works very well on it, but we haven't used paraquat like we've used glyphosate. Paraquat is more expensive than generic glyphosate. It also has a less broad spectrum of control, so it's good on broadleaf weeds, particularly smaller broadleaf weeds where you get good coverage, not terribly good on grassy weeds. If you have both broadleaf and grassy weeds, you're probably going to have to either tank mix with a grass product or come back with a grass product to control it.
The difference between glyphosate and paraquat is that paraquat has a skull and crossbones on the label, correct?
That's correct. Paraquat is a skull and crossbones, basically vaporizes tissue. It works very quickly. Growers, after they spray it, feel very good about it because things are dead quite quickly. It can cause significant health problems if it's not used appropriately. There's a lot of restrictions around its use, and a lot of farmers don't like to use it. Quite frankly, it's the one herbicide that I'm very, very, very careful with. I don't particularly like to use it, but it is still effective against a range of broadleaf weeds, and I think we're going to have to use it more in our systems than we have. So it's got a totally different mechanism of action. Paraquat and diquat are the only two chemicals with that mechanism of action, and we haven't inundated fields with it, and so it's still a pretty effective tool. Chemical control in fallow is going to become more expensive. We're looking at taking some of this more expensive chemistry and using newer technology like Weed Seeker, or Weed It, which are these techniques where you only spray where you see a weed. So that might make it more affordable, but we're going to have to move away from glyphosate or glyphosate only for fallow weed control, and that's going to drive up the price. When I was in Nebraska in the 90s, we had very little chemical fallow at that point. It was just too expensive. Glyphosate was close to $100 a gallon. Growers didn't want to use 16 ounces. They wanted to use 8 or 10. In 1999, I believe, glyphosate Roundup went generic. Glyphosate got cheap, and that's when direct seed or no-till took off. And it took off because of cheap glyphosate. If we now have to go back to more expensive glyphosate, I think direct seed, as we know it today, could be in jeopardy because its Achilles heel is its dependence on chemistry, and usually a very narrow range of chemistry.
So what are the strengths and weaknesses of direct seed from a herbicide standpoint?
Well, I'll approach it from a weed control standpoint. There are a number of benefits from direct seed. One is that because you aren't tilling the ground, you tend to leave the weed seeds on the soil surface, And those weed seeds are then more susceptible to predation by insects, birds, fungi. You tend to have a faster die-off of the seed bank when it's sitting on the surface, so that's a positive. In the Great Plains in Nebraska where I was working, direct seed allowed us to save enough moisture in the soil to allow us to move from a wheat fallow system to a wheat summer crop system. So we were able to use crop rotation to help get on top of some of our winter annual grass problems. So that was a real benefit. I guess the real drawback from a weed control standpoint is you get rid of an entire class of control tactics, that is tillage, and we tend to rely very heavily on chemistry. And that's really the Achilles heel. Because we rely so heavily on chemistry in direct seed systems, it puts a lot of, or can put a lot of pressure on weeds to develop herbicide resistance. We can try to ameliorate that by using good crop rotation, by using excellent crop sanitation, not making sure we don't bring any weed seeds into the system, make sure we control weeds on the edges. But it takes a lot more management than a lot of growers put into the system. So if you're going to go direct seed, you have to really commit to putting a lot more energy into the entire system and not just rely solely on chemistry, because weeds will develop resistance to chemistry that we use over and over again.
As currently defined, no-till, which is one pass across the field, is it viable in the long term?
I have my doubts that it can happen as currently identified, because I think, again, herbicide resistance will eventually win out. I don't think we're going to be producing enough new herbicides to keep us from developing resistance and making herbicides less effective. And if we make herbicides less effective, I think we're going to need to use tillage every once in a while. Now, I totally believe we have overused tillage severely in the past, and I don't want to see us going back to that kind of system. But I do think tactical tillage at the appropriate time and as little as possible can really help us with weed control, and can actually help us sustain the length of time that that herbicides are effective in our system. So I don't tend to be strong one way or the other. I think there's a lot of benefits to no-till and direct seed, but I actually think the more sustainable route would involve a little bit of tillage here and there. And as a scientist and as growers, I think our responsibility is to try and figure out how we can use it for greatest weed control benefit and least degradation to our soil resource.
I've done a few of these podcasts with important messages. This one, however, episode 46, The Challenge That Will Not Wait, may be the most important. Did you hear what Lyon said about the four fields with glyphosate-resistant kochia in the Midwest, and how those expanded to 2.2 million acres in just 7 years? I want to remind you that 2.2 million acres is the same amount of land devoted to wheat farming in eastern Washington. If you're a farmer listening to this, do me a favor. Make sure your farming friends have an opportunity to listen to this as well. Tee the podcast up on their smartphone or computer and give them the gift of understanding how to figure it out again. In other words, teach them to podcast fish. Instead of saying, I hope you enjoyed the show, I'll end with, I hope you took away some knowledge that will help you going forward, whether you're a farmer or simply someone interested in learning more about the complexity of raising a global food supply. Until next time, I'm Scott Yates, hoping you'll join me again for another episode of Weed All About It!
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home, they don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you. We feed you.